Welcome everyone to today's workshop on detoxification and alcohol. Thanks for joining me today, Dr. Yasmina.
Hi, Amelia. Hello, everyone. Great to be with you again.
Look, I am super excited to get stuck into today's session because we've got these two key sections of our biomarkers that we haven't really drilled down on in much detail, yet they are two pretty hero organs that do some very important jobs, and that is our kidneys and our liver, and really how well they are functioning. You know, if lack of energy, stubborn weight is an issue for you, then it's important to know how well your kidneys and liver are working and also how best to optimize their functioning. So the first part of today's session, guys, is we're going to do a deep dive into those key biomarkers and any others that might give us an indication of how well our body is detoxifying us. We're also going to talk about NAFLD, which stands for non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Sounds charming. We're also going to talk about the different stages of kidney function because kidney disease often has zero symptoms until about stage 4 or 5. So understanding our markers can be the only early warning signs that we get. Today, we're also going to delve into alcohol and which markers might be affected by excessive alcohol consumption, and of course, some strategies to help us reduce our alcohol consumption. Whew, how does all that sound, Dr. Yasmina?
All right. Well, there's a fair bit, but I'm sure we can work our way through it.
Look, what just keeps blowing me away is that each week I'm like, right, we've learned so much. Surely there's nothing more to learn, but I know today we're going to get our minds blown yet again and just completely unlock a whole new Pandora's box of discovery with our markers. So I'm super, super pumped. All right. We ready? Here we go. Okay. So where are we going to begin? Dr. Yasmina, let's start by understanding what our kidneys and liver actually do and why they affect our weight and energy.
All right. So kidneys and liver, I feel like are really organs that don't get enough credit, right? So you got to remember that all of your blood always goes through the liver and it always goes through your kidneys. And the reason we think of them as a major detoxification power factories is, well, yeah, most biochemical reactions related to detoxification happen in the liver. So that's where that work gets done. And then you go, okay, now we have got a bunch of metabolites that we have detoxified, and now how do we get rid of them? And
when you talk about a metabolite, a lot of our members won't know what you mean by metabolites.
All right. So let's take garbage that we dispose of. And you know, when you're disposing of your milk carton, you don't chuck the whole still blown up milk carton, you basically squash it. You fold it into little bits and then you put it in your recycle bin so it's not taking up a whole heap of space, right? So you have basically processed that milk carton. So metabolite is basically something that the liver takes. It's a compound that liver takes. For example, if we're detoxifying estrogen, you take an estrogen molecule, then you process it. It's almost like a chain reaction. There's a first stop, so phase one. There's a second stop, phase two. Then you make it water soluble. And then you need to, get rid of it. And that's where you either poo it out or you can pee it out, which is what kidneys come in and do. So liver is like a processing center and kidney is almost like a disposal center, right? So when the liver has turned it into something that you can actually chuck out, because a lot of things that we're trying to get rid of are not water soluble. And if it's not water soluble, you will not be pooing it and you will not be peeing it out. So once you've made it water soluble, then the kidneys will come in. And kidneys are like a giant sieve. and they will make sure that what we require stays in and that what we want to get rid of goes out.
Okay.
So that makes probably sense. The easiest, the most practical way of thinking of what kidneys and liver do.
Okay. How do they affect our weight and energy?
All right. So how do they affect our weight? So you've got to think about the kidneys. What one of the things that kidneys do is fluid balance, right? So if you have ever felt really kind of bloated, waterlogged, if you touch your lower legs and, you know, you feel, you know, leave your indentation marks, if you are waking up in the morning and you've got a puffy face and, you know, you feel like
you can't take your rings off at the end of the day, or you've got swollen ankles, things like that.
Exactly. So those things, for most people, they're transient. Something has happened and things are out of whack, but that gives you, and that will recover. But that gives you an indication of what fluid balance means in practice. So if you're, that is a, you know, and obviously it will affect your weight. Then how does it affect energy? Well, you know what? If you're swimming in toxins, a whole heap of biochemical reactions will be affected. You know, those toxins might be even affecting them, could be causing slight differences in the pH and the conditions in your body. And even those very, very slight changes can affect how hundreds of biochemical reactions work. It's really the, you know, the equivalent of not having your liver and kidneys working very well. It's like looking at the assembly line and the assembly line is jamming, right? And so, and it's basically those toxins that you are not processing properly, they're not getting rid of, are clogging up your system and slowing you down in general. It's just that we don't act, you know, hormones are really, really cool. Cardiovascular health sounds, you know, really interesting. But liver and kidneys, like, they really haven't received much love. You know, they kind of, you know, we think of them as boring organs, but we can't live without them, literally.
No, well, you can live without one kidney, but you can't live without two kidneys, and you certainly can't live without your liver. And what I think super interesting about what you're saying here, Dr. Yasmina, is that on Inner Vitality, we're all about getting to the root cause of what's going on in your body. And so if you're sitting here now lacking in energy and maybe you have got that fluid retention, well, then let's go through our biomarker results and let's get a sense of how well our kidneys and liver are detoxifying us and where they sit. I also just want to ask you, do they naturally decline with age? Like, if I've got a 30-year-old watching this video and I've got a 65-year-old watching this video, should they be expecting to have similar results?
Well, when we go and have a look at eGFR, right? What should have happened in the calculation, because eGFR, and I'll break it down what it actually stands for, but for the moment, it's just important to know that it's a calculation. So it is not something that is directly measured. And when you calculate it, what should be taken into account is your age, your sex, so whether you are male or female, and then one of the markers called creatinine, that so you take those things and plug them in, do some maths, and that's how you get that eGFR. And eGFR stands for estimated glomerular filtration rate.
So hard, right? To say. All right. So the numbers
should be different, but the where you are sitting on that green bar, right, should already be taken into account by the virtue of that calculation.
Okay. All right. That's really good to know that that calculation is kind of taking our age into account.
Yeah.
All right. Well, look, with that said, shall I share screen and you can maybe take us on a little tour of our biomarkers?
Yep.
Okay. Fantastic. All right. And so guys, if you can just have your iScreen results handy, that would be great. And can you see my screen? Has it popped up yet?
Not quite.
All right, here we go. So if you can just all scroll down to your UECs, which is your kidney function. We've got a member here. I'm not going to say who the member is today because we're going to be talking about alcohol and alcohol consumption. I think it's best I anonymize this member, but I have reached out to them privately to let them know, and their name starts with the letter P, so just so you know that that's you. Anyway, let's dive in and talk us through our kidneys.
You know what, Amelia, I'm just going to focus on a couple of things here mostly. So if we scroll further down, the main marker that we'll be talking about is that eGFR.
Okay.
The one other marker that I will mention that often can vary is that urea, right? So urea is a waste product. So, and that urea is it's a waste product that's also related to the protein consumption. So for those of you who have a really low urea, so this is not this person, but if you have a really low urea, this could have happened because you are really, really, really well hydrated, so you've lowered it down. It could also be because your protein consumption is not what it should be. And there will be some of the other things in the liver function test that, you know, if they light up as well as this urea, then that might be you. For those of you who have urea at the higher end, again, urea is affected by hydration. So that could be because you are really, really dehydrated when you did your tests. But it's also true that with declining kidney function, you might be looking at increasing urea. So if you're going, no, I'm not dehydrated, I haven't taken a big whack of protein or amino acid supplement, it's just when I look over my trends, my urea is increasing and my eGFR is going down, then that should be something that you're paying attention to. The other marker that we're looking at is a creatinine. Now, creatinine is another waste molecule. As iScreen points out, it's generated from muscle metabolism. So creatinine can be related to the amount of muscle that you have. And basically, if your creatinine, and you know, if you look at the creatinine and you go, somebody's got really, really high creatinine, that basically can mean that their kidneys are not getting rid of it, right? So we've got a problem that this sieve is not getting rid of creatinine. But it can also be that they're trending a bit high on the creatinine because they're a really, really muscly person. At the same time, if you are looking at the creatinine and you go, hey, the creatinine is looking great, but you hardly got any muscle on you, well, that could be because you're just not producing a lot. And that is why when we are looking at eGFR, and it's an estimation, as I said, it's a calculation, that is why we should be looking at sex, so you know whether male or female, so that takes there's a little bit of fudge factor where we account for the fact that women don't quite have as much muscle as men. There's that age thing as well, because we know that the muscle mass tends to decline by decline with age. And there, in fact, you know, most labs don't do it, But there is also, there are different ways to calculate eGFR, and some of them actually take into account weight as well. Mm-hmm. So if you want to just, it's possible to go online and find those particular calculations that will allow you to put that additional element in there, and you can play around and see what you get. But that's the,
Okay, so what you're, just to sum up what you're saying there, the eGFR is basically the kind of the hero one that we want to look at to get a sense of where our kidney function is at. And this is the one that, if those of you that read the Peter Attia book Outlive, he bangs on about eGFR quite a lot. Yasmina, there's also a chart that looks at the stages of kidney disease based on eGFR. Would now be a good time for me to share that chart and we can maybe talk through it? Or did you want to talk some more about eGFR first?
I just want to break it down as to, when we say eGFR, what it means, right? So first of all, as we said, E is for estimated. So it's a calculation. It's not a direct measure. Mm-hmm. G stands for glomerular. And glomerulus is a small working unit that your kidneys are made up of. And that working unit is essentially a bunch of tiny and very fragile blood vessels, right? That will become relevant. F stands for filtration. Filtration is what kidneys do. They filter your blood. So toxins and nasties out, useful electrolytes and water stay in, right? They decide how much water they'll get rid of. So that the F is for filtration. And then rate is basically how fast you're doing the filtering. How fast can you get rid of the toxins? So for those of you who have as your GFR declines, so that's actually that rate that declines. In other words, you're losing your ability to get rid of toxins fast enough, right? So, and that's the key thing. Yeah. But let's have a look at your chart, Amelia. Now we can figure out.
All right. And sorry, just before I move on to the chart, I think it's important to note, and I know we said this in a previous video, but see this number. So our member here is at 81. Lots of you Inner Vitality members have wonderful reading and yours will say 90, but it'll have a little arrow that says 90 or above. I just want you to know that the way that we measure here in Australia, that doesn't mean you've scored 90. It means you've scored higher than 90. So we don't know if you've scored 91 or if you've scored 110, but basically if yours is 90 with a little, larger than arrow, that's really good news. So I just wanted to make that clear. And it's funny, Yasmina, when you were just talking about, the rate of filtration, I was thinking of my pool filter and how, when the pool was brand new and the filter was brand new, the pool water was just sparkling and, it would do this automatic thing. And now it's 2.5 years old. And I went out yesterday and I'm like, oh my God, my swimming pool's eGFR has dropped in a major way. And I can, I'm thinking about if that pool water was my bloodstream, how much, that would be impacting my energy levels.
That's a fabulous analogy. That's exactly what it is. It's a fabulous analogy. Love it.
Are you my new pool or are you my old pool? All right. What are we looking at here? This is the this chart here.
Okay. So this is chronic kidney disease is something we really, really don't talk about. And part of the reason we don't talk about, well, there's really several. One is that it's basically silent, right? So
no
symptoms. So symptoms are so vague and we often put it down to something else because we don't really think of our kidney as such an important thing, So we ascribe them to something else. The other thing is that eGFR is something that as GPs, we'll often say, well, it's not great, but we will monitor. And we'll come back later to why we are inclined to say monitor for this one more than for some of the other things. Often people will be sliding down this eGFR scale well into, that 60 to 89 bracket, towards the bottom of that bracket before, and they will often not noticing any symptoms, but they will be around that 60, 70 before there'll be any conversation around kidney damage. And this is really, it's such a shame, because unlike some of the things that happen with liver, if you have had chronic damage to your kidneys, you can't walk it back. If you have had acute damage to your kidneys, so something has happened, like you've had a severe dehydration event, or you've damaged your kidneys with some sort of toxin. Sometimes it happens as a radiology contrast, or you have had a horrendous infection with a sepsis or something. We call that acute kidney injury, and kidneys can recover quite well from that. But this chronic insidious damage is, you kind of don't walk back from it. You can stop it, you can slow it down, but you don't really recover it fully. And that is why I think it's super important for us to really pay attention in the direction of those numbers and not start a conversation when we've really slid down that table.
Okay. Well, so this is really useful for us to look at our eGFR on our biomarker results and see what stage of kidney damage or kidney disease we're at. Hopefully we're in stage one or stage on the higher side of stage two. But once you're getting to stage 3A, B and below, you're wanting us to really pay close attention to it. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, if you are in that where GFR is somewhere between 60 and 80 and, I've got one such result, but is this real or what? Mm. And if you're not sure, if this is the first time you're seeing it, we'll repeat the blood test in 3 months' time. Mm. And if it hasn't recovered, if it's pretty much where it was or it's getting worse, well, that is a message that there is some chronic kidney damage happening for you. And it really, really is time for action to prevent further damage.
Okay, cool. Well, look, in the spirit of Inner Vitality being proactive as opposed to sort of, disease detection, although if we detect something, we of course on refer you to your doctor. I do want to ask, this chronic insidious, what causes that? You've just mentioned some acute things, but what causes this chronic kidney damage?
All right. Let's go back and think about what kidneys are made up of and what they do, right? So kidneys are made up of these small vascular units. They're called glomeruli, right? So each of those units is a bunch of tiny little fragile blood vessels. Mm-hmm. And so our job is to protect those blood vessels from damage, right? So here is in a basic terms what you need to do. So don't blow them up. Right? That's the first thing. Don't blow them up. And that means control your blood pressure. So your systolic blood pressure, should be around 120. That's lovely for the kidneys. Obviously, it's not going to be like that all the time, but that's kind of what we are aiming for.
Okay. And sorry, just on that, can I give a lovely quick analogy when you say blow them up in blood pressure? Going back to our garden next to the swimming pool, I want you to imagine you've got the tap and the hose, and you've just plugged the hose into the tap. And then you're holding the end of the hose. Okay. And then you put your thumb over the hose. And then you get your other partner to turn the tap on full ball. Okay. As hard as they can, as fast as they can. And the hose blows up. That's basically blood pressure. So if you had your thumb off the hose and you asked your friend to turn the hose on full ball, would it blow up? No, it wouldn't, because the pressure is lower. So if you've got, for whatever reason, an increase in the pressure in your blood vessels, that's what you're referring to, because that pressure that pops the hose off the tap is essentially what you're saying damages these super tiny blood vessels that are inside our kidneys. And I know you're going to say one more thing that damages those super tiny blood vessels, aren't you?
I'm going to say two more things. But let's talk about how you keep that blood pressure down. So low salt, lower. So if your blood pressure is running high, the first thing you need to think about is your salt intake. And my kids really laugh here because I think my husband, I'm really not good on my religious studies or anything, but I think my husband was called Methuselah because his wife turned into a pillar of salt.
Oh yes.
Yep. So that is how much salt I would love to use. And I used to be, just love salt, you know.
Yes, Mia. What's going on? You're a doctor.
But you know. And I used to be able to get away with a whole heap, because I was also sweating it out more and all of that. But that changes with age. And I know what my blood pressure is doing, and I know that I can't tip half a salt shaker on my food anymore. So sometimes those are the things that do change with age. Your salt tolerance can change with age. Check your blood pressure, check your intake. Check where your hidden intake is, because it's not just what's in your salt shaker. It is that a lot of processed food is really, really high in salt. So you might not even be aware of it. But generally, if you're eating stuff out of the packet, chances are it has a lot of salt in it, because salt helps preserve things, right?
And I'm going to pop in the cheat sheet. I did a Channel 9 Today Show segment on this exact topic last week. And I can tell you, because of this recent report that came out, 85% of our excess salt is coming from packaged foods. And I did a whole segment on the bench talking about it. So like one of the worst breakfast cereal culprits is Weet-Bix. And then I compared, for example, a passata, like a pasta sauce with chopped tomatoes, tinned tomatoes. Chopped tinned tomatoes have less than 15 milligrams of salt per 100 grams. 15. A passata, 650 milligrams per 100 grams. So can you see the difference between using a packet pasta sauce mix like a passata versus grabbing some diced tomatoes, chopping up some onions and popping them in? The other thing I want to quickly share screen as you were chatting, this little baby is a great tip for those of you that are trying to reduce your salt intake. Can you see that heart salt, table salt?
Oh, yes.
50% less sodium and something percent more potassium. It tastes exactly the same as salt, but everyone, if you're still, I don't even put salt on anything at home anymore. I even don't put it on my boiled eggs, which my mum is horrified about. But if you do have table salt at home, chuck it in the bin and go and buy this, $3. And that's going to make a big difference. And then really just start to get rid of that packet stuff, because it really makes a huge difference.
And you know what? If you miss the taste, just replace the taste. So the salt that I use these days actually has, it's only about 50% of actual salt. The rest of it is ground up dried herbs, yeah. Right?
Yep. Herbs are a great, yeah. substitute.
So replace the set. The other thing you can do to lower your blood pressure is lose weight. And easier said than done, but you know, we've talked about that a lot because it basically takes less work and less pressure to pump blood around a smaller person. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Okay.
And then be physically active. So we now know that there are several genes involved in the regulation of blood pressure that are exquisitely sensitive to exercise. So they respond to exercise. And if you want an experiment, go and exercise, then get nicely settled and measure your blood pressure. You're not puffed up, you know. So get nicely settled and then measure your blood pressure within 30 minutes of exercise. And I can bet that that will be your lowest daily blood pressure, provided that, you know, at the same time, you're not stressing about something else. So okay. The other thing that you saw, we said don't blow up those blood vessels, so don't clog them up. And this is when we talk about your cholesterol. So remember that controlling your cholesterol starts by controlling your blood sugar and insulin, and do what it takes. You know, if your EGFR is sliding down, so you've tried the diet, you've tried the exercise, you've tried, and you know what? If the cholesterol is not coming down, and if you need the meds, use the meds. Remember, reversing kidney damage, chronic kidney damage is not impossible, so prevent it. And then, back to those blood vessels, I said, don't rust them up. And by that, I mean, you know, remember a few weeks ago, we talked about HbA1c and we talked about sugar splatter marks and we talked about how those sugar splatter marks basically damage proteins. Well, this is the equivalent of rusting the piping, so rusting your blood vessels. And so when you are running on a higher sugar, on a higher HbA1c, that is what's happening. There's another vascular risk factor that we did not measure. Again, you know, we can't measure absolutely everything, and that is homocysteine. And homocysteine makes the lining of blood vessels more sticky. So for those people who want to do further exploration, thinking about homocysteine is another thing to look at some later stage.
Sorry, just to connect two dots, because you just said it quickly and I just want to make sure our members connected that. If you've got a high fasting glucose, which are the metabolic markers, in fact, let's use this member. If you've got a high fasting glucose and a low EGFR, could that be an indication of that rusting? So like
absolutely.
If we look at this member here, her EGFR is at 81. And if I scroll down to her metabolic markers, she's also got high inflammation. By the way, she's got a CRP of 5.45 and a creatine kinase of 196, FYI. We'll come back. Actually, she's also got high lipase, but I think we're going to talk about that in a moment. But I just wanted to show you her fasting glucose is in the red at 8, very much in the red at 8.1. So,
and the HbA1c is totally is also in the red
at 6.6. Right? So yeah. Would you argue that she's at stage 2 kidney damage, kidney disease. Would you argue that she's probably rusting her kidneys? Like
absolutely,
she's in that
rust
stage. And so is there hope for her that if she can bring these metabolic markers back into green, that you would like to see some recovery, or is it more about preventing any further damage?
It is largely about preventing further damage.
Okay.
But remember, the beauty of this is that if you bring your blood sugar control into green, if you bring your insulin down, if you bring your hormone down, it's not you know, it's wonderful for the kidneys. But in many ways, so you are stopping that rusting thing, yes. But you're bound to be losing some weight through that, so that's great too. We had a look at the cholesterol markers here, and I think cholesterol markers were okay, but I suspect this person is on statins.
Which is a good thing, right?
Yes, which is a totally appropriate thing. In this case, is a totally appropriate thing.
I can tell you that this member's BMI, because I looked it up, is at 33.
Yeah.
So she's on that, you know, she's carrying this extra weight. So I guess, do you care how they lose the weight? Like, is there somewhere where you go, look, we recommend that, you know, you would be a perfect case for going and having some, you know, a Zempic or going down that path, or it really doesn't matter how you lose the weight. You just need to get these metabolic markers in check.
Well, again, like, you know, look at the whole person, you know. I got in trouble as a medical student with a famous obstetrics professor because it was about a contraception, and I said, you know, it was, what do you take into account? And I said patient preference, and I got told that, you know, what sort of doctor am I, you know, aren't you making decisions what this patient preference thing is?
Oh, that's so terrible.
Yeah, I know. But to me, it really is front of mind, because I think it really needs to resonate with the person. So they need to, you know, they need to believe in and like what they're doing. That's the first thing. Second thing is they need to understand what they're doing, because only that way it's going to, you know, they're going to be committed to it. Has to work with their lifestyle. So those are the starting parameters. But then if you want to drill down to, you know, what makes sense, you know, scientifically, medically, well, you know, we've got a sugar problem here. We definitely do. And we've got a weight problem. And we do have a Ozempic, which we know will help control the blood sugar. We know will help weight loss. We know for some people, you know, Ozempic might be that first step that kind of nudges the needle. And that is just enough to make people feel like, okay, change is possible. Now I am going to make that second, third, fifth step by myself. And as that happens, they build the confidence and, you know, things really start changing for them. So that is a kind of a way that I look at it. I am really not dogmatic about how people get there. I think it's about that individual person.
Yep.
How, you know, and that is why during this program we've been giving people knowledge, we've been explaining what's happening so that they can, you know, they can own it. And that is why we've been giving people a range of different options of what they can do so that they can pick what works for them. And to me, that is really, really important, because I don't believe in one size fits all.
Oh, that is just said so beautifully. And it's such a lovely reminder to all of us and to all our wonderful Inner Vitality members that really is about, you know, empowering you to make that right decision for yourself. And Ozempic or not, whether even everyone that is successful on Ozempic are also making those lifestyle changes as well, where they're actually teaching themselves to eat more healthily, to exercise. And for some people, it's giving them the opportunity to do that because their joints are less achy. Yes. But if you want that long lasting change, you know, the number one thing that Dr. Yasmina and I, that it all comes back to, is making these healthier choices. And that's the not negotiable, that whatever the changes we make are changes that are moving our biomarkers in a healthy way. Okay. That's great.
Absolutely.
To know.
And you know what, like I kind of get upset with the pressure that people are put under. You know, sometimes I have people who come and see me and they're almost apologetic, you know, and then I really, really had to take antidepressants. I didn't, it's like, Don't apologize. You know, you did what you needed to do at the time, but look at all these other things that you have managed to do as well. So, you know, that's
Okay.
it's it really, I really don't want people to, you know, to be blinkered about a way, this is the way it has to be done. There's so many ways to do it. There's lots of freedom.
Fantastic. Well, look, let's circle back then to our kidneys and finish off there. And but we're basically, you were talking about how we can prevent that kidney damage. And I guess, is there, just finishing up on kidneys, is what can we do to support our kidney function? So over and above, you know, don't, what is it? Don't blow them up. Don't rust them out.
And clog them up.
Don't clog them up. Thank you.
Yeah, don't blow them up with your high blood pressure, right? Don't clog them up with your high cholesterol, and don't rust them up with your high blood sugar. That's kind of the simple, yeah.
Okay. So I love a bit of Eastern medicine. And I love acupuncture. And whenever I go and get acupuncture, there's always talk about kidneys and my kidney meridians and all of this. And I have to say that when I get acupuncture, I often feel this like rush going through my body, and I often feel really warm around my kidneys. I just want to ask your thoughts on acupuncture and on anything else that we can do to support our kidney function.
All right. So let's go on a supporting the kidney function, and you know, at the risk of being repetitive, is we've said
what not to do, but what should we do, if that makes sense?
All right, in the most simple terms, keep well hydrated, right? Okay. Keep clean. When I say that, it is you know, again, avoiding nasty toxins, and that's your dyes and solvents and pesticides and, you know, that kind of stuff.
The dirty dozen and the clean 15, have a look at those fruits and veggies, you know, all the highly processed foods. Do you live near a smokestack, or if you live near a busy highway, are your windows open or closed? All that sort of environmental toxin stuff, endocrine disrupting chemicals.
Exactly. And then I can't help but circling back to that that blood pressure, and we'll give people, you know, I'm going to go back to magnesium and say that's the first thing that you can do to lower your blood pressure. But going to, and you know, there's all those things that we have talked about before about the vascular health and metabolic health, and you know, we're not going back there. But with the acupuncture and the Chinese herbs, look, I don't understand how it works. Like, they're completely different way of looking at things, and a completely conceptually really different way of looking at the human body that I'm not trained in. But I have used acupuncture, and I have been a patient of an amazing acupuncturist, and I've used Chinese herbs, and I have used them at a time when I felt particularly fragile. I was going through IVF, and I've come back to them at the various point in my life. So to me, probably the most important things are work with somebody who is really knowledgeable in the area that you are trying to tackle. So, for example, I was seeing acupuncturist who had a connection to Melbourne IVF, which I was, you know, going through at a time. So I had a really good understanding of that fertility area and where she fit in there. And I think what's really, really, really important is to work with somebody who's willing to communicate with the rest of your medical team. So I had I was even referring people for acupuncture, but I was referring them to a person who was then willing to come back to me and say, well, this is what I think is going on. This is what I am going to give them. And by the way, you know, I'm aware of these possible interactions, right?
Okay.
So to me, those are the things to consider. And again, I think it's really, really sad if people have to hide the fact that they've seen naturopath or acupuncturist or a herbalist, or, you know, it's super important that there's an openness between your medical professionals and these other people who can be absolutely wonderful members of your team.
100% agree with you. I think that holistic approach is just brilliant. And that's why I love you as an integrative GP, because you are open to that. And a lot aren't. All right. Well, let's move on then to our liver. And shall we share screen and start with our biomarkers and go through a similar process, starting with understanding how well our liver is functioning. And those of us that drink a little bit, there might be some interesting insights in our liver markers as well. All right, what are we looking at? Which markers are important here?
All right, so we'll start from the top. So this person does not have that issue, but bilirubin is a marker that I often talk about, and the reason I talk about it is that how you process bilirubin is actually dependent on a bunch of biochemical reactions where we employ enzymes when there's a lot of genetic variability. And there is a good proportion of us, about 15% or so, who have variations, genetic variations that slow down these detoxification enzymes. So these are glucuronidation enzymes. And if that's the case for you, what you will have noticed in your bloods and perhaps over the years, when you do your bloods in a fasted state, that bilirubin tends to be elevated, right? And when I say, what have they got? They've got less than 20. I'm looking at when bilirubin is about 15 or up, right?
So okay, that's what so I call. Sorry, I'm just going to reiterate. So those members that have a bilirubin of potentially sort of 15 or higher, after they're fasting, this is what you're talking about. And is that a bad thing? Like, is that something you've got to be careful, you've got to watch? Because actually, I think you might be describing me, if I remember rightly.
I am, Amelia, because you're one of those people.
So what does that actually mean? So those with 15 or higher who were fast, who have been intermittently fasting, we just have to be a little bit careful of fasting. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So you are the guys who should be fasting, 12, 14 hours, not more, because the reason you are seeing that elevated bilirubin on your fasting bloods, and you might not be seeing it on your regular bloods, is that fasting can actually slow down those detoxification pathways, right? Those
detoxification pathways. Okay, but the problem is most blood tests are in a fasted state. They do say, though, because I had a couple of members email me where they accidentally, you're meant to fast for 8 to 12 hours before this particular, before the test that everyone got. And a couple of members, one member got rejected from their pathology lab because they had said they had fasted for 14 hours. And they said, oh, well, that's going to screw up your results. So come back tomorrow and only fast for 8 to 12 hours. So I guess my question to you is, because we're all fasting for 8 to 12 hours, would we potentially all be impacted by this, or is it something that builds up over weeks and weeks of extensive fasting?
No, you would all be impacted by fasting. It's just that some of you, about 15%, have a genetics where that fasting slows down these glucuronidation reactions. The other 85% have genetics that is not really affected by it. Right.
Got it. Okay. Yep. So just keep an eye on it and just keep those people. All right. And so what about this?
I just want to say a little bit more about it. Okay. There is a condition. So if you have those genetic variants, if you have higher bilirubin, you might have something that's called Gilbert syndrome. If you have a chat to your GP, they'll probably be told, oh, don't worry about it. It's completely benign. But it comes down as to how you detox some of those things. And it does come down, so people who have that feature sometimes can have effects on other things. So you might also, so you might find that you, if you're that person, you might be a little bit slower in detoxifying estrogen, and that might be showing up for you as a really heavy periods.
Night sweats.
No, that's more hormonal. So you are slower to process estrogen. So you're more estrogen dominant. So you have heavier periods. It might have an impact on mental health when bilirubin goes quite high. So people might notice that their anxiety and sleep disturbance actually correlates with the periods when those reactions particularly slow down. So that's just heads up for that.
Okay.
The other two markers, I'll leave the ALP aside for a bit, but the other two markers that we are really, really looking at are those AST and ALT. And basically, they are markers of liver damage, right? So if you, these markers and these enzymes are present in the liver cells, and if you, as you start damaging and blowing up liver cells, they are starting to show up in higher amounts in your bloodstream. That's basically what's happening, right? And again, we have a, what you call a lab ranges. And we have what I would call optimal ranges, right? So you see for AST and for ALT, that 35. So lab ranges are 35. For me, the
so 35, ALT is just for those members that are listening, not watching. The AST 35 or higher is red, and ALT also 35 or higher is red. Our particular member we're going through today sits at 32 and 33.
Okay. For me, those ranges are about 19, right? So wow. If you are sitting at 20 and above, then I will be looking, what is going on there, right? So, and the other thing to look at is your AST to ALT ratio. And so the first line is, right, where am I sitting? And you should be sitting at less than 20, really, on your AST and ALT.
Everyone, quick check.
And the second line is, if you are sitting, particularly if you are sitting in the red bar, so if you're higher than 35, so the next question is, what is your AST to ALT ratio, right? And it should be less than one.
So, what would this member be at 32 and 33? It's like 1:1, right?
It should be about one, yeah.
Okay.
But we are, so we are dividing it kind of in the two groups, right? So one is first, you should be sitting at less than 20. So that's your first hurdle. And if you are sitting at, you know, anywhere between 20 and 35, right? Going, so these are early signs that something's going, you know, not as well as we should like it. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, if you are sitting in the red bar, so if you are higher than 35 on those things, then we are asking, what is your ratio? And your ratio should be less than one. If your ratio is, you know, sitting around one or above, then we're going, this is likely non-alcoholic fatty liver disease happening. If your ratio is more than two, traditionally we think about it as there could be alcohol could be responsible for this primarily.
I'm right? not very good at maths. Can you just help me? Can you give an example? What would a ratio of less than one be if you looked at, like, if this one?
So punch in a, take your calculator, mm-hmm. take your AST number, you know, and then divide it by your ALT number.
And okay, you've got it.
So if you're getting, you know, anything, if anything under the less than two, right? So it's between one and two, then this could be effect of fatty liver disease. If you're getting more than two, then alcohol might be the primary driver of what's happening for you.
Okay.
Right? We have another indicator that alcohol might be responsible, and that's GGT or gamma GT, right?
Okay. What's this?
Even iScreen will tell you that, and we're taught this as a medical student, you know, when you're looking at the elevated gamma GT, and again, my number here is you should be less than 20. If you are more than 20, let's think about what's happening with your alcohol consumption.
Okay, that's a really big one. That's a really good one to know. It should be less than 20, but your GGT should be less than 20, but iScreen has got the red bar starting at 35. So your optimal range is quite different to the labs. This particular member here is at 21, and she did pop in her onboarding survey that reducing her alcohol intake was one of her goals. So I can only assume that, you know, that she does consume alcohol. But she's only just crept over your line. Yeah. Okay. Cool.
That's okay. We've got a number of other things happening. You know, as I said, I don't hang my hat on any one marker in isolation. That is why we keep going and talking about patterns. And you know, yeah. So gamma GT should be less than 20 here. Now, the other marker that this member has is very elevated lipase, and in my mind, that is really something that needs to be worked out, because we've had it at the pancreatic function. So lipase is elevated with the inflammation of pancreas, right? So with pancreatitis, there are lots of causes of pancreatitis, but one of them, and the most common one in our society, is again alcohol. So I would definitely advise this member to have this lipase measured again, have a chat to their GP, and actually try and work out what is the cause of this elevated lipase, because something's definitely going on in here.
Yeah, and I do remember you in our opening workshop very clearly saying that anyone with elevated pancreatic function in their lipase or amylase should, you know, that is the two markers that they really should go and have retested and speak to their doctor. So that's great to know. Yeah. Okay. All right, great. Any other markers that you want to talk about before we move into NAFLD?
So, you know, I mean, we've talked about some of those protein markers. And so if you've got really low albumin, if you've got a low total protein, and remember, if you've got that low urea, I would be thinking, oh, what is my diet like? Am I actually getting enough protein in the first place? And what's my digestion like? Am I able to digest those proteins? And if you go, I'm getting plenty of protein in, not sure about my digestion, just try some digestive enzymes, you know, for 2 or 3 months and see if those protein markers shift. So that's just the, you know, without, I don't really want to wander too far away from our focus today. But those are just a couple of things that I would say to people who are sitting low on these.
I know it's going to be us, and our members are wondering, digestive enzymes. Is there a particular brand that you like? You've put me on them before, I do remember, but is there a particular brand that you like?
Look, probably the most accessible one is, I think it's called Multigest. It's bioceuticals, and it's safe for most people, because you'll find that some digestive enzymes actually have HCl, which is, you know, very powerful acid in the mix. And people who have had reflux or have had gastritis need to be careful about that. But that bioceuticals, I think it's called Multigest. I'll send you a link as well.
Okay.
That does not have acid in it, and it's safe for just about everyone.
So yeah. Just to wrap that up, if a member has kind of on the lower side of protein, like this lady's on 72, is that on the, that's actually probably okay, isn't it?
Total protein is okay. Her albumin is a little bit on the lower side. Now, albumin is synthesized by the liver. So,
and urea as well is on the lower end of normal.
Yeah. So just, again, just think about what's in your diet. Think about if you have any digestive issues, and you know, if you go, I'm consuming plenty of protein, try some digestive enzymes. That's the first stop for that.
Okay. All right. That's great to know. Okay. Shall did you want to talk through any other markers, or shall we move on to NAFLD?
Let's move to NAFLD. And again, acronyms, but NAFLD basically stands for non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, right? And essentially what is happening there, usually the path is something like, you know, you're struggling to control your blood sugar, liver's having a look going, uh-oh, you've got an emergency here. I'm going to help you turn it, well, into cholesterol, triglycerides, then cholesterol, because that's going to solve your emergency. And then what are we going to do with that? Well, I guess we're going to deposit in liver and going to store it there, because that's, again, lesser of the two evils. Alternative is I clog up your arteries with that. But no, I'm just going to hang on to it. I'm going to deposit it in the liver. So that's basically what's happening. And some of the first signs of NAFLD are those elevations in liver enzymes, right? You know, nobody comes to you and says, you know, I've got terrible pain in my right upper quadrant. You know, people don't come with liver pain. People don't, like, it's silent again.
Okay. So when you say elevated liver markers, which ones in particular are the ones, if we've got, how do we know, what are we looking for in those markers?
So that's those ALT and AST. Right?
Okay.
So if you've got a full deck of, you know, a full hand, it is your insulin is going up, your HbA1c is going up, your CRP is going up, your cholesterol is going up, and those ALT and AST are going up. So that is full hand, right? That almost certainly, if you went and had an ultrasound, they'd be telling you there are markers of fat deposition in your liver, right?
Okay. Can you have NAFLD and not have a full hand? Like, what if you don't have all those markers, but your AST and ALT are over 20?
Look, again, as with most things, it's a degree off, right?
Okay.
It's not like you don't go perfectly clean and healthy and then boom, all clogged up. And then it's a question of what can you pick up? What can you pick up on an ultrasound, right? So it is a process.
Mm.
And the more of those markers you have go up, the longer they're up, you know, the higher they are, the further along you are in that process.
You know what gets me so excited when I hear you talk like this is I'm like, now that we know this and now that we have this as our baseline benchmark markers, we can in 12 weeks' time, in 6 months' time, in 12 months' time, keep retesting, whether you retest once a year, four times a year, you can actually see which way they start to track. And so you can get that idea of, oh my goodness, those little changes that I've made that may not be affecting the scales very much, but look at the difference that they're making to these markers. Or if they're not making a difference to those markers, then it's like, okay, maybe I do need to, you know, find a more serious approach because it's obviously not working.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I mean, there was a segment on BBC that was, you know, this miraculous thing that they that is going to change the transplant, you know, availability of livers that can be used for transplants. I was like, what have they done? You know what they've done? You know that about half the livers that are available for transplant are actually not usable because they're too clogged up with fat. Right, that in our society, okay. It's not, you know, yes, the barrier is donation, but another massive barrier is that the livers that get donated are too clogged up with fat to be useful as transplants. So this massive breakthrough was about finding a way to wash the fat out of liver and then make it usable for transplant. But it'll just, you know, it just tells you about the extent to which this is a problem in our society.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, wow. That's amazing what they can do.
And the other thing that I want to say here with liver, because, you know, it might sound, you know, a bit doomy gloomy when it came to kidneys, but with liver, you really are in the driver's seat. So if you find that you have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, you kind of, you know, you can go two ways. You can do nothing about it, and your next stop is what they call NASH. So it's non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. So it basically means you've accumulated fat. That fat's caused massive inflammation in the liver, and that inflammation is resulting in scarring and can lead to cirrhosis, right? So that's the path to liver failure. Or you can really reverse it. But the best piece of news is that even if you are, you know, in those early stages of NASH, of that, you know, the inflammation and scarring, you do some of these interventions that we've been talking about, you can walk your way back. In fact, if you do some Googling, you'll read things like, there is no drug that's, you know, that you know, can help you go from NASH to healthy liver. It's the lifestyle that has been proven that can help you walk back from NASH to NFL, to that fatty liver, only to then healthy liver, because liver is an amazing organ. It regenerates. So you can, it's entirely within your power to walk back.
Oh, that is so motivating. That is super. That like makes me just want to go and improve those markers and make those changes, knowing that that can happen. So then what can we do to support our liver function?
Well, look.
Don't drink alcohol. Reduce your alcohol intake.
I mean, honestly, reduce your sugar and reduce your alcohol. They're two main things. You know, they're really boring, but you can't escape that they have the biggest impact.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we've talked about exercise in all sorts of ways and how it's helpful for metabolic health. Again, anything that's good for metabolic health is excellent for your liver, and we spend a lot of time in that space.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is think about kind of those everyday things that you're doing. So if for whatever reason you are consuming truckloads of paracetamol, that paracetamol's got to be detoxified somewhere, and it is being detoxified by your liver, right? So again, those are the questions. Why do I need it? What are my alternatives? How can I ease the work of my liver, right? Mm-hmm. Then, so that's your, that's your kind of lifestyle-y things. Mm-hmm. Then there are supplements that can be helpful, you know, like NAC, which we've talked about, gets turned into glutathione. And the glutathione is really, it is a major antioxidant, and it's a liver protectant. And often people, yeah.
So just on that, members that did have elevated liver and kidney, or is it just liver or liver and kidney markers? Would you
mostly recommend liver, NAC, liver.
Would you recommend that anyone that did have those elevated markers should do a couple of months of NAC?
Yeah. And you know, people often ask me, like, you know, hang on, you're saying that NAC turns into glutathione. Why should I not take glutathione? Well, you can take glutathione, but NAC is a lot cheaper. It's going to turn into glutathione. And NAC is usually just easier because it comes as a powder, you know, you can put it on things, you can, you know, to have it in the water. Glutathione, if you want it to be really well absorbed, oftentimes it's a liposomal glutathione, so it's expensive. And then, you know, there are, it's a bit more complicated to take. So that's just, you know, your little practical tip.
Do you have a brand of NAC that you like?
Look, I usually use Biomedica, but that is because the Biomedica comes in has two options. So one is that powdered NAC, and one is they call it veggie NAC. That is in the, that's in capsules for people who just prefer to take it as a straight capsule.
And can you just sort of take it at any time, or is it something you have to have it on an empty stomach or with fat or anything like that?
NAC is pretty forgiving. Yeah.
Okay.
And when I want to demonstrate to people how effective NAC is, and I said, you know, if you showed up in an emergency department with, you know, paracetamol poisoning, liver damage, what they'll be doing is they're giving you an IV infusion of NAC, right?
That's what they'd be doing. Okay. All right. So that's supplements. Any other supplements?
Milk thistle. So
that's a tea. Again, I've got that as a herbal tea at home, I think. Yeah, I do.
Yeah. So it's, again, from the herbalist tradition, Western herbalist tradition, we know that milk thistle is a, again, liver protectant, helps detoxification, etc. So those are some of the main things that I would say.
And would you recommend milk thistle as a capsule or is it okay to have it like I do with the herbs as a tea?
For me, it's always the gradation. You know, if you if your liver enzymes are slightly elevated, you know, this is not an emergency for you. Have it as a tea. It's great. If you are somebody who needs more help and might be looking for higher doses, then it could be that then you might be looking at the capsule because you'll just be getting more of the stuff. Okay. More is not always better, but there is for herbs. Remember what you're doing. You're grinding the herb. You're extracting stuff. So sometimes you actually need to, you know, you just need a little bit more on board.
Okay. All right. So milk thistle. Okay. I'll pop all that in the cheat sheet. What about diet? You hear of these amazing superfoods, so cruciferous vegetables, but particularly for detoxification, often the blue and the purple fruits and veggies get touted. So your blueberries and particularly beetroot has been shown to have lots of amazing benefits. Would you recommend if we've got these elevated, if our kidney and liver function doesn't look fantastic, that we should also be looking for those purples and blues?
All right, so let's break down what those different things do. So if we're talking about cruciferous vegetables, so they are the your broccoli, broccolini, your cauliflowers, right?
Yep.
So what they have, the compounds that are found in them, they upregulate some of those detoxification enzymes in liver. So people like you who are running a bit higher on bilirubin, that's your friend, because those crisps will upregulate those liver reactions that will help those detoxification pathways that are a little bit slower for you. Mm-hmm. A supplement that I often use, it's a compounded, so it's prescription, but it's called a DIM complex. I call it DIM complex. So it's got DIM is those that compound that is found in cruciferous vegetables that upregulate those enzymes. It has some NAC in it, and then it has some calcium glucuronate in it. And calcium glucuronate, it's just like a little flag that the liver puts on these molecules that it's trying to detoxify. That's almost like a label that says, now you are ready for disposal. So that's kind of what crisps do. Now we are talking about those deep colored blues and purples. Generally, they're really, really rich in antioxidants, right? And again, so we're talking, when we say antioxidant, you are talking cell protection. That's what it is. And remember, we said NAC gets turned into glutathione. Glutathione is a really powerful antioxidant. That's how we kind of circle back to that. And then when we're talking about the beetroot, so what is it that beetroot has? What's a beetroot superpower? Well, it's full of nitrates. And that can be used to synthesize nitric oxide. And nitric oxide is the magic ingredient that can help your blood vessels dilate, right? And that will lower your blood pressure. So if you are seeing those super fit athletes chugging little beetroot shots, what they're really doing, they're loading up on this compound that's going to allow the blood vessels to dilate, which then means that it's easier for the blood to get to their muscles, and so the muscles can do their thing, right? So that's why those little beetroot shots are big in the athlete world as well. So those are that is what those foods actually do. That's why we're interested in them.
Okay. And if I could wave my magic wand and have our members having beetroot twice a week, I would be very, very happy about that, because it is, and it's so easy to cook with once you learn a few recipes. I've put some beetroot recipes in our meal plans, as you would have seen. I just want to quickly ask you, we're almost finished. We're so close. So hang in there, guys. With your DIM complex that you were chatting about a moment ago, you said that you prescribe it as a prescription and it needs to go to a compound chemist where they'll make it up themselves. Obviously, Inner Vitality members are only going to be able to get a script off you if they become a patient of yours. So my question to you is, because not everyone's a patient of yours.
You can assemble it. You can assemble. I just do it because it puts three in one and it's easy, but you can assemble it. You can get supplements that have DIM.
You can Google it and see them. So is there a non-prescription DIM complex that you can recommend?
I will have a look at that, but you can assemble it from three different things, right?
Okay,
you can
what
definitely
are they?
Buy DIM separately as a supplement. You can definitely obviously buy NAC as a supplement, mm-hmm. and you can definitely buy calcium glucuronate separately as a supplement. So I don't have on the top of my head a supplement that combines all three, but I am 100% sure that you can get the three separately.
So if I, in my cheat sheet, for those with elevated liver and kidney markers that are going to probably, want to take some supplements around that, you could give me those three. That's almost like a do-it-yourself DIM,
yes.
And I can put those in the cheat sheet.
Yes.
Okay, great. All right. Look, I think we're almost there. I have one final question for you, which is basically around alcohol reduction. It's a big goal of a lot of members. Do you have any advice and tips for those wanting to reduce their alcohol intake?
You know what? It's first of all, I would say, again, it's such a personal journey, right? And it is when I say it's a journey, I think just like quitting smoking, reducing alcohol, the important thing is that you know, we have data for smoking very clearly, but I think this applies to alcohol as well. The average number of times a person tries to quit smoking is 8. So they relapse 8 times on average. So, and the way I like to flip it to people is like, no, you have not failed. You are one attempt closer to being able to do it. Right. And so I think that is really, really important that when you know, if you've tried to do it and something happened in your life and you slip back, it's not a failure. It's a one attempt closer to being able to do it. There is a website that I really like. There's a page that basically says that rethink your drinking. And I'll share a link. And what I like about it is they have a bunch of different strategies, and they actually allow you to tick those strategies that you would like to implement. And then you can print out the thing and say, okay, these are the strategies that I've committed to. So we're not, you know, there is about 10 different things that you can do, but you can select a couple that really resonate with you and go with it.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, you know, is just keeping the track and, you know, having alternatives to drinking. So maybe you pour kombucha in your champagne glass instead of champagne, you know, being aware of those, you know, triggers. You know, I'm going to go to my book club tonight. I know there's going to be the white wine, the red wine, the champagne. You know, if I don't want to drink, what am I going to do, right? So am I going to bring along some non-alcoholic wine? If I'm going to bring a sample of kombucha, am I going to bring some sparkling water and I'm going to dilute that white wine? So, you know, have your strategy.
Yep.
You know, and then have your ready to go. You know, if you have to come up with the story, sometimes it's just easier to say yes, right? So and they have lots of those useful tips.
Yep.
And then I'm going to do something that I'm usually reluctant to do, and I'm going to talk about the book that I have not read. This is really dangerous, but I have had a number of patients who have stopped drinking, who have told me that one of the best books on alcohol and the relationship with alcohol is a book called This Naked Mind. Again, I have not read the book, but it keeps coming up in the conversations that I have with people and for some of my patients, that has really been, you know, they say it's been life-changing for them. So I'm putting it out there.
Oh, that's a pretty good endorsement. I'll definitely be putting that one in the cheat sheet as well. Fantastic. Thank you, Dr. Yasmina. They're all really great practical tips. And I think just like with a lot of the behavior changes that we've been doing in Inner Vitality, it's really up to you to look at those crucible moments in your day, week, month, and year and really drill down and go, well, what can I do ahead of time to mitigate the desire? Because the great thing about us is that we're creatures of habit, and you know, likely these temptations have come up thousands of times before and they're going to be coming up thousands of times again. So let's think in advance. And look, it's a great conversation for the community as well. And often my best tips come from my members, like that kombucha with the wine glass came from a wonderful member in another program I ran that just worked wonders for her, because then she still got to do the ritual every night and got to sit with her hubby and chat about their day. And she had the cut glass with the, you know, ice and everything. And so she felt like she wasn't missing out, but she obviously just didn't have the alcohol. We are done. I think that's everything I wanted to ask you. Has that covered everything that you wanted to cover, Dr. Yasmina?
I think so. And again, if people have a, you know, we raised the some topics that people need some more help with, they can always email us. Happy there to help. So
Absolutely. And I've got a newfound respect for those quiet little achievers of our kidneys and our liver, and some really interesting markers for us to keep tracking over time. So thank you everyone for sticking with us. And Dr. Yasmina, as always, thank you for your amazing advice and wisdom.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Okay. See you next time.
See you everyone. Bye. Bye. Bye.